CityView. I'm Eileen Bowerman. CityView is an alternative monthly published in Des Moines. This reading is the second episode from the April 2024 issue of CityView. Our first article today is The Politico Mercury by Dennis Burns. It's titled, The Beekeeper is a Not-So-Subtle Trump Fantasy Movie. Two of the villains are so clearly based on Hunter Biden and Hillary Clinton that the political figures should get mentions in the credit roll at the movie's end. If civil judgments don't drain the Trump machine into cashlessness, the former president may want to open up theaters in the swing states for free showing of the Jason Statham movie, The Beekeeper. Screenwriter Kurt Wimmer may accidentally inspiring MAGA, may be accidentally inspiring MAGA more effectively than any speechwriter in Trump's infamously off-script political orbit. The Beekeeper is a trope built on a conspiracy theory packaged in improbability. It's far-fetched fare and marvelously funny until you realize, sitting in a dark theater, laughing out loud, at a level where you can even disturb yourself, that most people around you aren't similarly laughing, for they are not all in on the joke of this cult classic, a movie so bad it's good. Unless you are MAGA. Then the movie is something of a hero's journey, a cult classic in another sense, the dangerous one. The Beekeeper, with an estimated two-month box office run and now streaming, is in that can't-take-your-eyes-off category. Right there, with randomly rolling across car crashes, like the vehicle I saw on fire having flames on the shoulder of I-380 outside of Iowa City a few months ago, and attending a Trump campaign rally. I'm a veteran of the experience. The movie, with wild, ridiculous, and to be fair, entertaining narrative threads and ill-considered scripting and plain, weird plot swings, is, at its core, a Trump propaganda film. I'd had no interest in seeing the film until I listened to the Big Picture podcast with Amanda Dobbins and Sean Fennessy. Dobbins' takes on movies are the best I've heard since Roger Ebert. The podcast raised the connection to our modern politics. And they are right. It's there, the references to the Clintons and Bidens. Two of the villains are so clearly based on Hunter Biden and Hillary Clinton that the political figures should get mentioned in the credit roll at the movie's end. The Biden and Clinton send-ups are outrageous caricatures, but they are, with so much that is Trump, both funny and frightening. Here's how it all unfolds. Warning, this is a spoiler alert. Statham's character, Adam Clay, lives a monkish life in rural Massachusetts on a farmstead where he is, oddly, seriously, hold the irony please, a beekeeper. The owner of the property, Felicia Rashid's Eloise Parker, is a surrogate mother, grandfather, and benevolent-seeming landlord to Statham's dude, whose pining, pensive ways let us know he was up to something serious, some menacing or necessary and deadly business, before taking the quiet life turn into a honey of an emotional redoubt with Rashid. A retired teacher who runs a nonprofit, Rashid's character is tricked into turning over bank accounts to an online hacker-hackster ring led by Josh Hutcherson's Derek Danforth. Hutcherson, who steals the show in this film, inhabits the role with joy and gusto. Depleted and ashamed at getting scammed, Eloise, Rashid, commits suicide, which puts Statham on a mission. We learn that he's a member of a select, clandestine organization known as the Beekeepers. High-level bureaucrats populating the movie react with a knowing terror and second helpings of overacting when the beekeepers are mentioned. Stratum looks to avenge the death of his landlord, Rashid, whom Gen Xers like me always see as Mrs. Cosby from her Claire Huxtable days. Also in the hunt is Eloise's surviving daughter, Veronica Parker, who happens to be an FBI agent, played by Emmy River Lampman. Statham and River Lampman quickly learn that the ringleader of this phishing scam at Hutcherson's character, who was, in fact, the very Hunter Bidish son of the President of the United States, he drinks and does drugs and even vapes. Amid controversy with the walls closing in on him, Hutcherson does what one would suspect Hunter Biden would do, hold a rave at his mom's presidential retreat on the beach with day drinking and, oddly, day dancing. Gemma Redgrave's President Danforth is a Hillary Clinton knockoff in the First Order. She learns that her campaign was, in fact, financed by her attic son's skillful crookedness in ripping off old people. Poor Hillary. Well, I mean, President Danforth. In the movie's final scenes, Statham, acting in a Trump-like, I alone can fix it fashion, arrives via scuba gear on a beachfront compound jammed with Secret Service agents. He infiltrates the rave, corners the Hillary and Hunter characters, and doles out justice before action hero leaping, impressive from a 50-year-old Stratum, from the window and returning to the sea. The hero's journey is complete. And that was the Politico Mercury. Douglas Burns of Carroll is a fourth-generation journalist and founder of Mercury Boost, a marketing and public relations company. Joe's Neighborhood by Joe Wieg. Expedition to the top of the head. Always carry a snack pack. My dermatologist slowly goes over my bald head with gentle fingers and a calm voice. He dictates to his assistant as he goes, much like an explorer taking notes on the unusual flora and fauna found in the remote and inhospitable landscape. Blah, blah, blah. And here's a blah. Oh, my. More blah, blah, blah. Ouch! Look at that blah. And this would be a blah also. Please note, some people call this a barnacle. Now, let's go to the other side of the head. Although I am merely part of the undergrowth, I startled to hear the word barnacle somewhere in there. Without a doubt, as we age, strange things happen. What was once physically up there is now down here. Or, hold on to your pants, completely vanished from the face of the earth. But really? A barnacle? I guess my head now looks like the bottom of a boat, too long in the water. Of course, I don't tell my dermatologist that I am not surprised to have a barnacle or two up there. As I edge into my seventh decade, I have immersed myself in books about aging, death and dying, health and longevity, moral and spiritual rebirth, and whether it is better to eat buttery popcorn or a cream donut. Trust me, these books range from Seneca's How to Die, a fun catchy title, to Counterclockwise by Ellen Langer. I particularly love the Langer book because its unstated conclusion is so bold. It is your own fault if you die. Yep, you just don't have the right mindset to turn back the clock. Oh well, better luck next time, you loser. But a barnacle? Well, sure. I'm either a guy with a crustacean cemented to the top of my head, or it's a sign that I'm a pirate. I'm going with the pirate. Not the crazy Barnacle Bill, the sailor type of pirate, but the more waggish Captain Jack Sparrow type of pirate. In other words, isn't it time to morally pillage and plunder regardless of popular opinion? Since I have a barnacle on the side of my head already, I might as well wear shorts in the winter and five-toed shoes year-round and listen to John Prine songs in public and let anyone use my bathroom without proof of gender. How about that, you crustacean field landlubbers? But my dermatologist doesn't start with barnacles. He gently feels around the parameters of another bump, dictating all the while. Blah, 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 blah. What do you think? Blah, blah, blah. Fatty tumor? Blah, blah. Harmless. The indignity of it all. If I'm going to have a harmless tumor, do we have to call it names? In the downhill ski world, they call a raised protuberance a mogul, not a fatty tumor. Skiers love to cut back and forth, carving those bumps deeper and deeper. They are as challenging and fun as the person demonstrates at Winter Park, Colorado. I know this because I'm safely on the ground looking up while eating a cheeseburger. But honestly, how many bumps have we all had in our lives? Too many, for sure. Have I skied around them all with laughter and joy? I don't think so. I've plowed into a few with a direct hit and barely made it out on the other side. But I sort of admire that dude, the preacher of Ecclesiastics fame. Besides inspiring the song Turn, Turn, Turn by Pete Seeger, the preacher does have a great message. Eat, drink, and enjoy the moment, because there ain't much else but moguls ahead. Oddly enough, I find that inspiring and can get my head around it, especially my fatty tumor head. Back in the dermatologist's office. As for this, my dermatologist says, while pausing to touch my head, this is a spot caused by sun exposure. Oh, a liver spot. For starters, I don't think the liver gets quite the star turn it should in our society. In my family, I suspect this bad rap was due to my dad, who ate pickled pig's feet and dined on liver and onions. Gross and traumatic. And yes, I'm a hypocrite. When I found myself in France in front of a plate of foie gras, goose liver made into a paste that is not in any way approved by PETA, I swooned with delight. Dining aside, Mayo Clinic weighs into the liver fray. The liver has the greatest regenerative capacity of any organ in the body. In other words, if they cut out part of your liver for a transplant to help someone else, it grows back for you and for the guy with no liver. Amazing! So a liver spot on my noodle? I'm going to go with it as a mark of regeneration, growth, and scrappiness. Why not? Pickled pig's feet in my future? Undoubtedly. My dermatologist pats me on the back with a smile, chit-chats for a moment, but needs to get to the next patient. The expedition to the top of my head comes to an end. I am left sitting on the examining table in my underwear. Alone. There are a few things more special than sitting in a doctor's office alone in your underwear, which is why I always carry a snack pack. My granddaughter taught me this, and you should do it too. And don't forget, nuts and dried fruit aren't all you include in your doctor visit pack. Grandpa, we can also have two marshmallows in our snack pack, the big ones. So I nod with my recently explored head and have a marshmallow. Or two. Joe Weig spent 31 years bumping around this town as a prosecutor for the Polk County Attorney's Office. He's now retired. He writes about the frequently overlooked people, places, and events in Des Moines on his blog, www.joesneighborhood.com. The People and Pets column is by Jackie Wilson. This week it's his and her dogs. Zeka and Aspen offer companionship to the Stenrooses. With two dogs in the home, Morgan and Monty Stenroos decided they needed a larger home with a fenced-in yard. They found a home in Grimes where dogs Zeka and Aspen can roam freely in their backyard. Morgan's dog, Zeka, is a mixed-breed mutt and originally lived with Morgan's sister. Her sister's other dog and Zeka didn't get along, so she gave Zeka to their parents to take care of her. However, when her parents moved to Florida 4 years ago, Zeka stayed with Morgan, and she fell in love with the dog. It was now Morgan's dog. As a youth, Morgan had many pets, including dogs and cats, on their family's farm in Minnesota. She was also surrounded by goats, chickens, quail, ferret, hamsters, rabbits, emu, and guinea pigs. When she moved out on her own, she had a guinea pig. It passed in 2020. I was really sad. They are social animals, Morgan said. Shortly after that, she got Zeka. It's a great companion to have around, Morgan said. Monty's dog is Aspen, a plot hound. He obtained Aspen as a puppy, a descendant from his grandparents' dog in Wisconsin. Aspen is a fierce hunting breed. Her siblings were bobcat and bear hunters. She's gone hunting with them in Wisconsin, Morgan explained. When hunting, Aspen wears a GPS tracker in her collar. Monty's grandfather has baits on hunting property. If the bait is hit, they let Aspen take off. She stands by the base of the tree. They are trained to hunt the bear. For example, if it goes up the tree, the hunter knows where to go on the map as we watch the GPS signal, Morgan explained. The GPS collar has proven to be entertaining, even when not hunting. We download a map of the area and we watch her run around on the map, taking off, chasing squirrels or rabbits. The two dogs at home get along and play well together, yet they aren't affectionate with one another. We separate them if Aspen gets riled up. They don't cuddle, they just coexist. They'll take Aspen to dog-friendly spots where they can have a beer. We can't take Zeka, she gets too anxious. The cold, snowy winter was rough on Aspen. Aspen hates the cold. She keeps barking and wants to go outside, but once she's there, she barks to come right back in, Morgan said. Both dogs provide companionship, entertainment, and snuggles. Now that Zeke is getting older, she's 8 now, she's cuddler. Aspen will snuggle and let you pet her once she settles down. She and Monty are delighted with their dogs and the new space for them to romp around. I feel like I'd be bored without them, she said. They are like part of our family. And there's a color picture. Morgan is in the middle. She has long hair behind her ears, and then it comes down over her chest. And she's sitting with Aspen. Aspen is kind of a mottled gray and white with a few black spots. She has black ears and a large black spot on her back. And Zeka is a beige dog, and she's sitting looking straight out at us. She has very upright ears and a collar on, and Morgan has a hand on each of the dogs as she's sitting on the grass, and there's a wooden fence behind her. Here are a couple of book reviews. This is courtesy of Beaverdale Books. The first one is Diavola, D-I-A-V-O-L-A. Family drama, with all of its undercurrents and toxicity, is not a new concept for a book. But mixing that particular brand of unsettling anxiety with the slow dread of a deliciously gothic haunted house story is so much fun. Jennifer Thorne is at the top of her game in this genre-blending new novel that absolutely swept me away. Something is wrong in the beautiful old villa the Pace family has rented in the Italian countryside. And it's not just one sister's biting remarks or the parents' willing ignorance of the exhausting family dynamic. Anna is the clear outcast in the family and the only one who notices the creepy vibes in her temporary home. The villagers clearly know something about what is going on, but Anna is left alone to navigate both her caustic family and something even more insidious on this vacation that will leave all kinds of scars. This meticulously paced and immensely satisfying book is easily one of my favorites for the year. I highly recommend it for all the black sheep out there who get a shiver up their spine when they hear the words family vacation. That review was by Julie Goodrich. So the book is Diavola. It's by Jennifer Thorne, and it came out 3/26 of this year. It's 304 pages, $27.99, published by Tor Nightfire. And the other book is The Age of Magical Overthinking. When I read something that feels like therapy, I tend to make a scrunchy face. Mental health books are not my jam. However, Amanda Montell is different. Her witty, sharp writing can cut me to the quick, but I'm usually laughing too hard to feel the ick. Fresh off of her best-selling book, Cultish, Montell has decided to show us the equivalent of This Is Your Brain on social media, with plenty of relatable personal stories, research, and compassion. She dives into why magical thinking is so prevalent right now and the ways in which it twists even our closest relationships. Montell isn't against TikTok tarot card readers or the worship of Taylor Swift. She boldly shares her own foibles in this regard. Instead, she builds a very timely and forgiving story that shows us why we're all so anxious these days and the gasping attempts we're making to gain a little control over the bonkers world in which we've found ourselves. For a book that seemed destined for my not-for-me pile, I was shocked by how much I love this one. Who knows, maybe it was just good vibes made manifest. And that was also by Julie Goodrich. The Age of Magical Thinking, it's by Amanda Montell. It's out 4/7/24, 272 pages, $28.99, and by Atria, A-T-R-I-A. Here's the City View pole position. Results from last month's poll. The question was, how much do you spend on gasoline on average each week? Well, 50% say they spend $1 to $25 a week. The next two are neck and neck, 16.66% say nothing. And another 16.66% say $76 to $100. And then there are smaller amounts of 8.33%. They're both tied. That's $51 to $75 or $26 to $50. And the other question from last month's City View is, do you believe there is life on other planets? An overwhelming 92.5% said yes. 7.5% said no. And here are a couple of retweets, and these comments are unedited. One person says, don't tell me there's not a housing crisis. In the 1980s, we had so much housing, every pizza had its own hut. Someone else says, if one more person stands up and talks about their alcoholism, I'm quitting this book club. Another person says, it's dress-up day tomorrow at daughter's school, Vikings. One of her more eccentric friends, who likes to think outside the box, is going as an oar. Another one is, kids, be like mom. Look at me when you're driving 70 miles per hour on the freeway. Another dude mass says, find someone who looks at you the way a 125-pound dog looks at your lap as you're trying to eat dinner on the couch. And the last one is, after checking my credit report, the realtor showed me a vast array of tents and fancy cardboard boxes in the woods. Well, that does it for this episode of City View. We've been reading from the April 2024 issue. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. If you have any questions about this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. Thanks again for listening. Thank you.